on legal issues related to special education and various forms of school choice. And I believe, am I right, Dr. Mead, that you also were a high school teacher at one point?
No, I wasn't a high school teacher. I taught children who are deaf and hard of hearing. I did teach kids at all levels at one point or another.
All right. Okay.
But so. a typical high school teacher, I was not.
Okay. So the reason Dr. Mead is joining us today is that she has been studying the implications of the recently passed biennial budget for K-12 education and the UW system, and I invited her to share her insights in order to help our listeners understand the changes to our state's education system within this budget cycle. So just to begin with, I wanted you to perhaps explain for our listeners what the biennial budget is, the process it follows, and how items are included or not included in the budget.
Well, the way our budget process works in this state is the first step is that the governor solicits budget requests from each of the state's agencies, and then each of those agencies solicit their budget requests, or provide their budget requests, excuse me, and then the governor puts all those together in a proposed bill, his executive budget. That's then sent to the state legislature, and at the state legislature, there is a joint committee on finance that, as the name implies, it has draws members from both houses. And that joint committee then reviews the budget, makes amendments to it based on proposals they think are important. They may add to what the governor has provided in the executive budget, or they may take something away, or they may pass it as it is. And so they go through a process, a period of time. And I should say prior to that, they usually do what are called listening sessions across the state to hear from people about the governor's proposed budget and what's been published about it. And then when they kind of get down to it, the committee meets. At that point, it's an open committee hearing or committee meeting. So members of the public can attend the meetings, but they don't collect any, hear from anybody in the public. They just do the business of the committee. Eventually, once they've made all of the amendments, they pass the budget out of committee. That then goes to both houses. Both houses then debate it. It's in both instances, it's an up or down vote. In other words, each representative gets one vote for the entire budget. They don't vote on pieces and parts. Now, like any bill, they can, even at that last stage, can propose amendments to change it. And each of those amendments would be voted on separately, but eventually they vote on the budget, one vote up or down. If it passes both houses, then like any bill, goes to the governor for his signature and or veto. And so then he can do line item vetoes for some of the provisions if he so chooses, or he can sign the budget as a whole.
So in your estimation, since I assume you've followed these budgets in the past, has this process changed at all under Governor Walker in the current legislature, or has the same process been followed all along?
It's my understanding that it's the same process all along.
Okay. So it just sort of depends on who's sitting on those committees, I suppose, as to
exactly
what makes it into the bill. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So many items that concern education have obvious budget implications, and we'll talk about those in a bit. But sometimes items that don't seem to have obvious budget implications end up in the budget. I think one that most of us would
yes
recognize is there was at one point there was proposed that we end certification standards for grades 6 through 12 for teachers. And so do you have any idea how those end up in there?
Well, somebody along the chain, if you will, puts them in there. So our process permits policy items, so non-fiscal matters, to be placed in the budget, even if they haven't had a separate or hearing on that particular idea. So it's possible for brand new ideas that have not been subject to the typical kind of scrutiny that we think about when an idea is presented to a legislature. So even if that hasn't happened, they can still be put in the budget. And when that happens, then again, at the end of the day, each representative gets one vote for the budget as a whole, regardless of how many new things are in there or are not in there.
So let's turn to the ones that seem to be fiscally related. What are the major changes in the budget that you see that will affect K through 12 education? Maybe we can just make a list and then we'll look at them individually.
Well, I think one big change is that for the first time since they were instituted in 1994, there are will be no changes or no change in the revenue caps across this biennium. So in neither year of the budget will school districts be permitted to change the amount of money that they spend per student without going to a referendum, getting explicit approval from their local voters to change that. So that's a big limitation. It means that unless the state provides more money, there's no additional money available. It's also then results in the first time ever that Wisconsin is estimated to be below the national average for per pupil spending on education. It will be, Mark, I believe it's the eighth consecutive year of no change in the amount of money that the state provides for special education, and likewise no change in the amount of money that the state provides for instruction for English language learners. It continues a pattern of voucher creation and expansion. So we both created a new voucher in the special education voucher, and we've expanded the statewide voucher program. We've also created a new charter authorizing mechanism so that there can be more independent charters, charter schools in the state. There's also now a mechanism for removing the control of some schools in Milwaukee, taking the control away from the elected school board and turning that over to the county executive, who can then turn the school over to a variety of other options for operating that school. So I think those are the biggest changes.
So let's just take a look at the list that you just made for me and kind of take each one at a time. It's obvious why, you know, school funding is a budget issue. That's probably one of the biggest budget issues. But if we're really freezing the amount of money available to public schools, what are the short and long-term budget impacts for that item?
Well, the short term, of course, is that a freeze is a cut, because we have not frozen expenses. And so if expenses increase, but you're operating within a fixed amount of money, a fixed amount of income that you can bring in, then you're going to have to cut just to maintain that amount of money, right? Mm-hmm. So a freeze is, in fact, a cut. So, you know, a simple example is if insurance costs go up, like just liability insurance, for example, then the school district is going to have to find the difference somewhere, and they're going to have to cut something else in order to pay that increased expense. That would be true for transportation or any of the number of fixed costs. The other thing I want to make clear is we have a pretty complicated system of school finance. And so the revenue caps are a bounded system that provide the majority of the funding that schools get. And it's composed of money collected through local property taxes, and also money collected or provided by the state, collected through taxes that we pay into the state, and then the state provides back to the school districts through state aid. And the way the system works is that that revenue caps limits the amount that those two together can be. Now, there is, you know, a change for the second year of the biennium, which would amount to an additional $100 per student of a separate category. But that $100 per student is not likely to offset all of those other costs that we, you know, we've been talking about.
So how does this compare with previous budgets? You said that it's we're in our eighth year of no change for special ed and ELL funding, but...
We are not yet with this budget. So through 2017, we are still budgeting less per pupil than we did in 2011, to give you an example.
Okay. And
so we haven't recovered from the, we took an enormous cut, school districts took an enormous cut in 2011 in Act 32, and they haven't recovered from that. And this will, the revenue caps are, will be at the same level they've been for since 2014. So 2014-15, 2013-14, 2014-15, 15-16, and 16-17 will all have the same revenue caps imposed, unless, of course, as I mentioned, a school district can go to the voters in their district and request an increase in the revenue cap or permission to levy more taxes locally. But unless they do that or the state increases the revenue cap, that the school district has to stay within that bounded box, if you will, that they've had since 2013-14 school year. And so you can imagine, you know, just thinking about that, what things cost in 2013-14 and what they cost now, and of course what they're going to cost a year from now, you can see that a freeze results in a cut.
Now, one of the things you said is that we're now below the national average. So does that mean other states are not cutting? Some of them probably
are. That's correct.
So other states are either maintaining or raising.
They're reinvesting. So, you know, right after the recession, of course, a number of states cut because of the deep effects of that recession. But the majority of states are reinvesting now that we're on, you know, coming out on the other end of that recession. Minnesota is an example that's been reinvesting in public education considerably, but we are not.
So let's take a look at the next thing, which is voucher expansion. And I guess special ed vouchers is sort of a subset of that same issue. So what are the long and short-term budget impacts for this item?
As we move to privatization, it means that we are spending more money subsidizing the private choices of individual families in private schools. And what happens in those private schools beyond you know, meeting the requirements for participation in the program and the definition of what it means to be a private school in the state of Wisconsin is up to the parents. The same kind of accountability provisions are not in place. But that also means that monies that were to go to the school district now get moved into the voucher program. And depending on the situation in your school district, that can be a heavy hit or a slight hit, depending on how much state aid you got. So to fund this program, what the funding is it does permit the students who are attending private schools by means of vouchers to be counted for the purpose of revenue caps and limits. But the money then kind of comes to the school and then goes back out. But the amount of money that goes to a student in a private school is a sum certain. Each elementary school student who exercises a voucher, $7,210 goes with that student to the private school. For a high school student, it's $7,856. And for a special education student, it's $12,000. And the money is taken from the amount of money that would have gone to the school district for state aid purposes. So if your school district doesn't get that amount of state aid, then that means that some of that money has to come from some other source.
So, for example, if you are a property-rich district, say one of the wealthier suburbs of Milwaukee, then you as taxpayers locally are making up the difference?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
What they're saying is that you have to, they're going to pay for it with your general state aid and your categorical state aid per student. So what they would do is the money, so again, this gets into the, it gets kind of into the weeds, right?
That's okay.
So a school district gets general state aid, and then they get a set of categorical aids that come to the school district. And the categorical aids, as the name kind of implies, are designed to serve a particular purpose and often a particular service that school district is providing to a particular group of students. Not always. We've got a set of them, and I'll try not to make this too complicated. But so, for example, the categorical aid that you get for special education, to fund special education, and the categorical aid to fund English language learner services. So first, what they would look at is, okay, how many kids are exercising a voucher? And can we make up that difference in the state aid? So if funding this number of private school students takes all of the state aid that would have come from the state to that school district, all of that state aid then gets paid, is used to pay for that voucher. And then they look at categorical aid and they say, well, now we're going to reach into those categorical aids if we don't have enough to pay for to make that amount of the voucher. And of course, once you're doing that, you know, so if I as a school administrator am expecting to get an amount of money either through state aid or categorical aid that now gets paid for the voucher, I don't have that money to use for what I was anticipating I was going to be using it. So it creates a pass-through mechanism. It depends. Now that, you know, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau put out different estimates throughout the year as we were working this through. The lowest amount, I think, was around $37.1 million additional dollars for the next 2 years of the biennium to fund the, that's just the expansion of the statewide voucher program. And then they're estimating for the next 10 years as the limitations on the number of students who can participate in the program get taken off. So we're right now for this next school year, it's a limited to 1% of any school district's membership. But then, and then the next biennium again, 1%. And then in 2017-18, it'll go up to 2%. The next year, 3%, and so forth. That the Legislative Fiscal Bureau is estimating that it'll cost between $600 and $800 million, depending on the number of students that participate in the program. And a number of these students, I will say the fact that you can count them for your enrollment purposes is at least helpful. That blunts it a little bit, blunts the hit a little bit. But the fact that this will fund students who have never attended public school is also an issue that some folks don't understand. So this doesn't necessarily mean that a child who exercises the voucher previously attended a public school. They may have been attending a private school all along, and we're merely shifting who's paying their tuition from a private person paying the tuition to now the state through the voucher is paying for the tuition.
And so in what way is this a change from the way vouchers were funded before?
Vouchers funded before were funded out of a separate pot of money. and now they're doing it kind of some have called it a pass-through. So, you count them for one purpose at the local level, but then the money comes in and the money goes right back out again. Before, they used a kind of a special pot of money that the legislature set aside for this purpose. Now it's all kind of rolled into the state aids that are there. So depending on the school district and how many kids' exercise vouchers, it can have a large effect or a small effect depending on that school district. But every school district could have some effect because, again, as you're, no one is talking about making the whole pot as a whole bigger. Mm-hmm. So if the pot from which all of this money is being drawn is not getting any bigger, then the more that we're sending to private schools means that we're going to be reducing the amount available for public education.
Looking specifically at special ed vouchers, I remember, was it the summer before last, there was a set of hearings. It was not part of the budget.
Right.
And at that point, it did not get passed as a standalone bill. So why did it appear in the budget, and how is this potentially an issue for special education students?
So how did it get into the budget? It got into the budget because someone inserted it there. Mm-hmm. And you're correct that when it was a standalone bill, it did not get sufficient support in order to be enacted into law. So one of the issues about putting anything into a budget bill is that it makes it harder for folks who oppose it to have it taken out, and makes it easier for somebody who champions it to have it enacted. Because again, if somebody is going to vote against this idea once it's in the budget bill, they have to vote against the entire budget. They can't say, I'm going to vote against this part of the budget, but I want to vote for the rest of the budget. They can't do that. Mm-hmm. So it means then that it creates political pressure to pass something that you can argue might not have, well, in this case, did not survive when it was a standalone bill. The problem that those who are disability advocates have with this is that there's a number of issues with it. One, there's no requirement that the private schools who take the voucher actually provide any special education or related services or have personnel with the expertise to do so. And so that leaves folks vulnerable, parents vulnerable to marketing, if you will, when they make this transfer. So if a parent exercising a voucher in this manner is going to lose a number of rights that are afforded to them under federal disability law. If they exercise a voucher and they determine that, in fact, their needs of their child are not being met, then the only thing that they can do is to move their child again. In the public system, of course, there's a robust system of rights, rights to be involved in the development of the child's program, rights to be informed of any changes that are made, rights to be informed and request evaluations, rights to challenge if they think the school district is not maintaining a sufficient level of education. But those rights are gone once they exercise the voucher.
I'm going to just take a moment to reintroduce you. I'm Karen Sconzert. I'm a host of this program, and I'm interviewing Professor Julie Mead from the University of Wisconsin-Madison about the legal implications of the recently passed state budget for our education system in the state of Wisconsin. So another thing that you listed before as a big change in this budget is the Charter Authorizing Board. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things that's really interesting about our state that makes charter schools a little ambiguous is that our charters, at least in Kenosha and most of them in Racine, are actually run by the school district, and they kind of function more as specialty schools, but the employees are district employees, and they get paid the same way. Whereas if you go to, say, Chicago, there are chains of privately run charter schools, and they tend to have employees that are quite young because they're less expensive, and the administrators tend to get paid a lot more than typical administrators, that sort of thing. So how is what is proposed in the Charter Authorizing Board different than our locally run and, I would have to say, very popular charter schools that we have in our districts right now?
Well, one thing I would mention is that actually nationwide, if you look at charter schools nationwide, still the majority of charter schools are chartered by their local school districts.
Okay.
So we're not that unusual in that regard. As you mentioned, there are a significant number of states that permit other entities to charter schools, and then those entities even a public school district could contract with a for-profit charter vendor to deliver their charter school if they wanted to. But here in Wisconsin, we have for many years had a system where statewide, the majority of school, for the majority of the state, the only charter authorizer was the local school board. And the local school board could elect to create a charter school or to authorize a charter school, and they could do two types. So one type is what we call an instrumentality charter, where the school board employs all of the teachers and all of the personnel in the same way that they would for any traditional school. And the second type is called a non-instrumentality charter. And that's where the school board acts as the charter authorizer, but the charter school itself employs all their personnel. And although the majority of our charter schools across the state were in the first category, we did have a few that were in the second. Then in addition to school boards as authorizers, in Milwaukee, we had three special authorizers: the Milwaukee Area Technical College, which has never exercised its authority to charter a school, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and the Common Council of the City of Milwaukee. And they have the authority to charter schools within the city limits of Milwaukee. When they do so, those charter schools are independent or non-instrumentality charter schools, which means that they are their own employers. They're not in any way connected to the school district, not any way connected to Milwaukee Public Schools. And then we also have one other special authorizer, the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, which had the limited authority to authorize one and only one school, which it did. By creating a new charter authorizer, so the Board of Regents has to create an Office of Education Opportunity, and they will have the authority, that office then will have the authority to charter schools in districts with more than 25,000 students. And then you also have the county executive of Waukesha County. What essentially that it does is it creates a de facto appellate process and the operation to create more independent charters. And of course, once an independent charter school is created, then the students who enroll there may come from any variety of school districts because of open enrollment, statewide open enrollment. So the Department of Public Instruction estimates that this new to our charters would affect, that the original proposal at least would have affected 177 school districts in some way. And then, of course, because of statewide open enrollment, if parents were willing to take their child to wherever that school was, it could, you know, it had the potential to affect any school district. Those independent charters get a guaranteed amount of $8,075 per student. And that's, you know, so you might have a school district that the local school district may not get that amount of money in state aid, but that state aid then is guaranteed for that student. And again, like the voucher programs, the school district in which the child resides can count the child for the purposes of revenue caps and so forth. But then that, again, that money flowing in and the money flowing out. So, that's how it's currently listed to operate.
And then the last one that we talked about, it's somewhat related, I guess, is the idea that you can each year, is it five schools, supposedly the five lowest performing schools, would be removed from the Milwaukee Public Schools elected school board and given to the control of the county executive to reconstitute or do whatever, I guess?
So the low-performing schools, then the county executive can either turn them into an independent charter school, can turn them over to a private non-sectarian choice school to operate, or this nebulous any individual or group not currently operating a school, whatever that means. I don't know what that means. The way the law is written, it applies to Milwaukee County or schools districts with more than 15,000 students. So although Milwaukee Public Schools would be the one most immediately impacted by this. It also could apply to other school districts. West Allis, Madison, and Green Bay are those most likely to be affected in the future because of the way that they've defined when the takeover can happen. But so the upshot of the whole thing, of course, is that the schools are now under the control of the locally elected school board. Once the takeover happens, they would not. And one of the things that I've been looking at, but at least to date have seen nothing to indicate that there would be, would be once that takeover happens, there doesn't appear to be any mechanism to bring that school back under the control of the locally elected school board. So this is going to have a direct impact on local control of the schools in the community.
So we've looked at sort of those big items in the budget. I just want to ask a few questions about specific items. So looking at vouchers, so a lot of people listening to this show might actually have their kids receiving vouchers and, you know, want to know what exactly is the problem with just letting parents take the tax dollars to whatever school they want. I mean, isn't education supposed to be the issue of the parents?
Well, definitely, of course. Each of us as parents, and I'm a parent of three daughters, has an interest in how our children are educated and a primary interest in how our children are educated. But for as long as this state has been in existence, because we said so through our Constitution, we've made collective promises to each other so that there's a recognition that we all benefit when communities' children are educated, whether we have children or not, and whether there are children or not. And so through that mechanism, then, we have held schools accountable. We've set what is to be learned, and we've defined what it means to be educated. We've looked at kind of minimum expectations. So, you know, if you think a long, long time ago, I think about my grandma when she was a one-room school teacher outside of Janesville. All teachers had to do was to, at that time, pass a test, and if they did, they became a teacher. But over time, we've said that collectively we want more, right? We want our teachers to understand child development. We want them to understand pedagogy. We want them to understand psychology. We want them, you know, we want them to understand a number of things in order to make sure that our kids are getting the strongest education possible. And so that licensure stands as kind of a promise, you know, at least that the teacher has had this kind of training. And then we can go through each one of those things. If we, as we've changed curricular standards, then you know that the school at least is providing this. We had litigation over the years to make sure that all kids could attend every public school. So whether the child had a disability, whether the child needed to learn English, whether the child fill in anything, right, any status characteristic, that we were going to ensure that the public schools served every child. And so as we move to a privatized system, we're really tinkering with what is public about public education. Those who support vouchers often use the phrase "a voucher in every backpack," which suggests that the only thing of interest to us is the idea of public funding. But I argue that there are at least five aspects of publicness, public funding being one, but public purpose, public access, public accountability to communities, and public curriculum are also aspects of publicness. And as you move to a privatized system, you're losing that. So absolutely, private schools, and we have many fine private schools in the way that we have many fine public schools in the state of Wisconsin, provide a public purpose. But if you will, in a private system, the priority, if you will, the ranking is that they serve the private interests first, not the public interests, whereas in a public system, the public interests have to be served first. Public access, private schools don't provide services to kids with disabilities, for example, unless they choose to. They are not required to. They don't provide services to kids who are learning English. They're not accountable to communities in the same way. So, of course, as a community member, if I think my school board is doing something really good, I can go to the school board meeting and say so. Likewise, if I think they need to do something different, I can go to the school board and say so. And I can both attend meetings and see how decisions are made and weigh in on those decisions in a public forum. I can also, of course, vote for folks that I think would be good school board members and not. And, of course, that's also true at the state and national levels where public education policy is also made. In a private school, none of that is applicable. So you attend. Of course, you can vote with your feet and go to a different school, but you don't have the same kind of influence or ability to influence what's happening there. And that's certainly true. You know, if I have no children, my ability to weigh in on public education policy is the same as a parent. But if I am not a parent, I have no ability to weigh in on how money is being spent in a privatized system at all. So it, again, diminishes local control. It diminishes public control. And in terms of that public curriculum, private schools have to promise to provide a curriculum that addresses kind of the big things that we would expect: reading, writing, math, and so forth. But how they teach, what they teach, does not have to be the same as what happens in a public school. And in public school, of course, we've decided collectively what has to be taught and what has to be offered and so forth. So it's a shift. It's a big shift in terms of really what is public about public education.
So another thing that I see pointed out over and over again when people are having discussions about vouchers is that private schools, a lot of them, or at least a lot of them that participate in the voucher program, charge less tuition than the per pupil spending of the public school districts they're in. So doesn't that make it more efficient? Isn't the budget just going to save us a lot of money in the long run?
I'm not an expert on school finance, but I would point you to some of the research by Bruce Baker, who kind of lays out the problems with this particular thinking. But just some general things that I can mention is that, remember, that per pupil amount that you see for public schools includes everybody who attends a public school. So it's not the per pupil amount that is necessarily comparable, because you have special education costs and all of the kind of expensive costs that go wrong with serving the entire public rolled in to those costs. And that's not the same. The other thing that, you know, in terms of using tuition as a marker, that you have to be careful of is that private schools, not always, but sometimes, don't rely solely on tuition. They rely on other forms, right? Foundations, donations, that philanthropy of some sort. So whether or not those costs are the same. And then you also have to look at what it is you're purchasing. So in a public school, you know that every teacher is going to be licensed, which at a minimum means they hold a bachelor's degree. To participate in the vouchers, they do have to hold a bachelor's degree, but they don't necessarily have to be licensed teachers. And so, you know, those kinds of issues and costs are shifted. The other, you know, kinds of expectations that we have for public schools in terms of providing gymnasiums, for example, and those kinds of outlets for educating not just the mind but the body and the, you know, the kind of the whole child, are again not the same in private schools. So some are, again, as I mentioned, we have, in the same way that we have considerable variance in public schools, we have considerable variance in private schools. But you have to be careful to do an apples-to-apples comparison, and those numbers are looking at just kind of the base comparison and do not always do kind of an apples-to-apples. Are you looking at the same costs there?
I'm kind of shocked to see that we're running out of time here. So I'm going to ask one sort of wrap it up question, to see what your sort of take on the whole budget is. So if you're using your expert lens, if you're looking at these changes overall as a large package and then maybe even considering the previous biennial budget, what does it tell you about the direction of K through 12 education in our state, and what are the long-term impacts likely to be?
Well, I think that the thing that concerns me the most is that it appears to be a divestment in public education, and I'm greatly concerned about divesting in public education. We have long recognized that we all benefit from a strong educational system, whether it's looking at the cost of homes and, you know, the fact that the value of my home is impacted by the value of the public schools that are in near proximity, whether it's looking at, you know, the basic training that an educated workforce needs, all of those things. We've all recognized that we benefit from looking at a strong public education system, and I'm very concerned that we are, in fact, moving away from that, and I'm concerned that the once the kind of hits happen, our ability to recover that which we've lost may be very, very difficult. It's concerning to me as a public school advocate. It's a concerning to me as an advocate for children. And I think we need to be very, very cautious when we make these big changes that we're doing so mindfully. And I'm particularly bothered that we have elected to make these shifts in and pushing toward privatization largely in budget and omnibus bills. So, for example, whether we're talking about the original Milwaukee Parental Choice Program, which was in a large bill that included lots of things, not just that was not a standalone bill. And then, of course, every expansion since has been part of a budget bill, but it doesn't permit us as concerned citizens to weigh in the same way that we would in a standalone bill, and that I find troubling.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. This was a program featuring Dr. Julie Mead of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we were discussing the implications of the Wisconsin budget bill just passed on K-12 education in our state. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support for WGTD comes from the Racine Literacy Council. RLC is holding training days for those who register to become volunteer tutors, August 18th and August 25th from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. at 734 Lake Avenue in Racine. Visit racineliteracy.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Lemon Street Gallery's featured exhibits for the month of August include ceramic artist Betty Gong, painter Rob Hafferman, and photographer Stephen Santamore. The exhibit will be on display until August 30th. For more information, visit lemonstreetgallery.org.
Support comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, featuring freshly harvested and chemical-free produce from Michael Holland, including kale, summer squash, green beans, and garlic. Kenosha Harbor Market opens Saturdays from 9 to 2. Online at kenoshaharbormarket.com. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to 91.1 FM, WGTD. This is Marlo Harmon, your host for today's Community Matters segment, where we discuss important issues that are relevant to you. This year, we've seen some significant cuts in Wisconsin's budget for education, and for the most part, funding for K-12 public schools next year will not increase. I believe that many would agree that a quality education is essential to our society and to our children. So how can we build the educational foundation of our children while still being fiscally responsible? There may not be an easy solution, but at least we're going to talk about it today. And today's guest is Ms.